Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Why are small and medium CPG, consumer packaged good companies, so important for the regen transition? They touch all the parts of the food web. They source from farmers. They have processing facilities or co-packing facilities. They interact with large distributors and supermarkets. And they interact with consumers. And in all of these relationships, they can nudge and disrupt for regeneration. But maybe most importantly, they are nimble and can turn a company around in a matter of months or years, as we learn in the interview today. Plus, why we should focus on regeneratively disrupting meat and dairy and not waste too much time on the very crowded plant-based space. The real innovation is happening and has to happen in animal protein. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the Planet Mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today we dive deep into the food side of things with the founder and CEO of Nu. Welcome, Rafaela.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
So to start with the personal question we always start with, how did you end up focusing so much on soil and regeneration?
Actually, this started, well, I started the company 5 years ago, but looking on regeneration was only 2.5 years ago when my twin girls were born. And it was 6 months before COVID hit. And I live in Rio and my parents' farm are in Minas Gerais. And when COVID hit, we went back to the farm, me, my husband, my two kids and my dog in the car. And it's a 12-hour drive. And while we were driving back to the farm, we could see the difference from the, you know, Atlantic forest to Brazilian savanna and how agribusiness impact, you know, the landscape that I used to see since I was little. And when I got in the farm and I had these two kids of 6 months old and I was running a food company, I started questioning myself, the impacts of the company that I was creating, the future of the kids. And I decided to investigate how the impacts of food system. And I remember the first number that I saw was FAO's report from 2014, saying that if we still do things like we do, we only have 60 harvests left. I know that that's a statement that has a lot of discussion nowadays, but that was the first time that I saw, you know, how broken the food system is and that we need to fix in some way. And back then, well, all of my products use dairy ingredients, and back then the only solution was to go plant-based. And I was so like, it didn't make any sense for me, because cheese bread started, you know, in the 18th centuries, and it wasn't common for me to think of the recipe in as a plant-based. So I was confused and trying to find a way, and I saw Kiss the Ground and I learned about regenerative agriculture, and that's where it all started.
And let's unpack a bit. You mentioned just like that in passing cheese bread, which is the foundation of your company. For anybody that doesn't know what cheese bread, I mean, you can make an imagination, but describe to us what is cheese bread? What is the cheese bread you're selling, and what is cheese bread mostly in Brazil?
Yeah. Have you ever tried cheese bread?
I haven't, no.
Oh my God. Okay.
So I'm looking for a visual. I'm looking for a visual description, as we are in audio, obviously. Like this is, we're recording this on Monday morning, very early for you. So what would a cheese bread look like? How does it smell? How does it taste?
I need to
for
grab people to, some, to connect. I just ate some today in the morning. I just baked some, but cheese bread is for Brazilians sort of like croissant, as in France, or like bagel in US. It's the number one bakery consumed in Brazil, and it was created in the 18th century. Actually, the history behind it, it's so interesting, and I think that a lot about regeneration, we don't talk so much about cultural and impact, and you know how cuisine is founded and how it was created, and the needs for us to preserve old recipes. But and that's why I find cheese bread history so interesting, because it was created in the 18th century, probably by a woman slave, and she. We used to eat bread with wheat that came from Portugal, and the quality was really bad. And we would eat, we would pick eggs and cheese and milk and some sort of fat in the farm and mix it all with wheat and make a bread. And at some point, some woman decided to leave the wheat out of the equation and put the base of indigenous cuisine, that is tapioca, that's manioc. So she used...
So switched the grain, the imported grain or wheat for an indigenous substance, and then it became what it is now.
Yeah, and so this is so unique because, you know, it took... Well, it was here before Brazil was colonized by Portugal. It was, you know, everyone was eating manioc. It's a root that's originally from the rainforest, and that's what, you know, what gets the flour, the tapioca flour, the yuca flour, and that's what cheese bread is. It's yuca powder, eggs, cheese, milk, butter, salt. It's so simple. It's clean label, and yeah, it's a huge market in Brazil.
And you decided to set up a company focusing on that, and then how different, let's say, is the cheese bread now compared to 5 years ago when you started? Like you said, I've been only on a journey for 2.5 years. I think that's quite a lot. Honestly, I think many people arrived a lot later. That journey of 2.5 years, what has changed in the company? A lot of things, obviously, but in the cheese bread itself, like if we compare the two, would we recognize huge differences if we look them next to each other?
Not really. The recipe stays the same, and that's one of the things that we do at New. We open all of our recipes, just because, you know, if you want to do a recipe in whatever you are, you can do it. So if you go online, you have the ingredients, and the ingredients didn't change. We used to use smallholder farmers ingredient and just raw milk cheese and all this super neat products. But what changed was the way that we do it. That changed a lot, because we used to produce in a co-packer. And when I was investigating this impact of the food system, in the future, I saw that a lot of startups and food techs, they decentralize the whole operations just because it's more... it's easy that way, so then they can focus on scaling up. And to me, when I found, you know, the impact that we make producing this product, I saw that we needed to scale deep. And that's when we decided to create our own factory and to look at this made at the source value chain and see how we can go to smallholder farmers and bring knowledge of regenerative agriculture and agroforestry, and just pivot the model to try to bring impact to the whole chain. So that's what changed. But the product itself didn't change. And we launched other products also after that.
Yeah, let's unpack them in a second. But just for the cheese bread, how big is a normal cheese bread? Is it like the size of a croissant, the size of a bagel? Is it bigger or smaller? And how do you eat it? Is it mostly breakfast?
It's different sizes, but it's smaller. It's sort of like... Well, you can see me, but people can't see me, but it's that big.
Like a coin. Like, a Bitcoin.
A little bit bigger. And you bake, and it's like a little ball. Like cheese, they say cheese rolls in US as well. And you bake it in the morning, so you can do it in your air fryer or in your oven. I mean, you just bake it for 15 minutes and it's ready. And here people in Brazil eat obviously at breakfast, but we sell to a lot of restaurants that eat, that put it in their entrees, and hotels. If you go to any hotel in Brazil, you're going to have cheese bread in breakfast. So yeah, it's very spread.
And when did you decide to launch products alongside that? Was it before or let's say after beginning of the pandemic or your regenerative journey started?
It was after. So cheese bread, if you go to a supermarket here in Brazil, you're going to have a frozen sector of cheese bread as big as pizza, for instance. So it's really big. It's almost 2 billion reais market in Brazil. When you look at cheese bread, what happened, and that's one of the reasons that I found the company, was that the cheese bread that was created in the 18th century and that you can find in the farms are not the ones that you're finding, obviously, in the supermarket, because companies ultra-industrialize the product, and sometimes they don't even have cheese, even though they're called cheese bread. In Portuguese, they're called pão de queijo. So it's all like, it's the same translation. So that was the hint that I had to bring back this recipe to consumers. And then after a while in the supermarket, and we're today in the biggest retailers in Brazil, we saw that only with one product, we couldn't deliver all change, and we wouldn't be so relevant to retails as if we had different products. And then we looked at manioc, and there is this interesting book from Alex Atala. He's, I think, the biggest chef today in Brazil. And he launched wrote this book called Manioc. And if you're interested in knowing about manioc, it's an amazing book. And he goes to indigenous villages in the rainforest and see how many sub-products you can have from manioc. So you can have something to drink, you can have something to have sweets on it or salt, or just it's so wild and naturally gluten-free. So we started developing other products with the same base as is in yuca. So we launched tapioca sticks. That's only three ingredients, tapioca, cheese, and milk. And now we launched five SKUs of gluten-free tapioca pizza. And this line was created after we put the three pillars on regenerating SMEs and CPG brands. That's the made at the source, the production, you know, the factory, and product pipeline. Because product pipeline, if you think if you put regeneration in front of any product launch, you just, you know, there is a wheel that you pull. Virtuous will, and that's what we did in the last launch.
And this tapioca has obviously been indigenous, has been in Brazil forever. Why is it such a interesting plant, let's say, from the food perspective? There are a million different ways you can consume it. And from a soil perspective, why is it an interesting one that you said, okay, we need this in more products, we need to get closer to this specific plant?
I guess that we are now we did a project with Preta Terra to find out how we can put manioc and other savanna trees in the same agroforestry and see how this root can increase soil and you know, work in the ecosystem. But what we see today that is, since it's naturally from Brazil and it's so vast and there's so many people using and producing, and obviously it's originally from the rainforest, but it's all around Brazil. We just want to use what's here, what's local, and see, because today every production that we see here from manioc, it's monoculture. We don't have it implemented in agroforestry systems. So we don't know how it's going to be after we're doing the project with Prisa Terra. And that's what we want to find out. What are the inputs that we have compared to wheat, for instance? We don't have that number today.
And I mean, there are so many different ways to take it, but how has the consumer responded? Like, we've often heard, I mean, it's already tricky to put organic on. I mean, most people don't really know what's behind the labels. And then when you take it to a whole new level, which is regenerative, what have you done on like packaging, on communication, or maybe nothing? You just go for the taste and the rest follows.
We did some stuff.
What has been that communication journey or that conversation journey with your yeah. consumers on this journey?
I'm laughing because regeneration is a tricky word, right? People just don't know how to pronounce it. It's not so spread here in Brazil, and that's why. It was so interesting to find your podcast and this movement going around the world. But in Brazil, it's not so. Consumers don't know. There are people working in food business that know about regeneration, obviously, but the consumers don't know about it. So we don't put regeneration in the packaging. What we did was we're carbon neutral today. So we put it carbon footprint in the product and some other stamps that defines all this circular economy and the fact that we are woman owned and the fact that we are carbon neutral and we're using smallholder farmers ingredients. But regeneration as a word, we don't put it in the packaging just because it's sort of talking about yoga a year before yoga is mainstream.
And everybody looks at you like, what are you talking
about?
They don't see. I mean, even though in Brazil, it seems like, especially in the agroforestry side of things, it's extremely developed compared to other places. There's so much happening on syntropic agroforestry and agroforestry in general. Of course, there's so much happening on the agribusiness on the other side as well.
Yeah.
But there seems to be quite a bit happening there. So if you're like, in terms of sourcing, in terms of talking to people in the business, in the food business, do you see there an interest in these topics? Do you see there, is it easy to find your peers and people to work mm-hmm. with and to source and to build these products at the end? Because at the end of the day, you're making things that end up on the supermarket shelves of the biggest supermarkets in Brazil.
Yeah, no, it's not so easy. Well, you may have this impression that things are going here in Brazil in terms of, you know, agroforestry and syntropic movements because you have some good players, but it's not, you know, just commodity and it's just so huge here. And obviously the government doesn't put any energy whatsoever in regeneration. So it's a bubble. And what we did was to find this peers, as you said, and the people that were working in the field. And one of our counselors that's in our board of advisors, it's from Fazenda da Toca. Do you know their work?
I know their work. We have never been, obviously, because I've never been to Brazil, but also I haven't interviewed them. But we interviewed a few people, I think, that have worked there. And
Preta Terra, but just and to, TV, yeah. all of them, yeah.
But just describe for the people that didn't listen to that, what is Fazenda Toca?
Fazenda Toca, it's from, so there is this big chain in Brazil called Pão de Açúcar. It's the second biggest one in Brazil after Carrefour. And the founder's son used to be a pilot, actually, from the Formula One. How do you call that? The car.
Oh, a race car driver.
Yeah.
Formula One race car driver.
Yeah. And he left everything and just bought this farm and started working regeneration. And now they're the biggest egg producer in Brazil. And they also started working with grains. So they're the biggest corn organic.
With Rizoma, right?
Yeah. With Rizoma Agro. It's in the farm. And now recently, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, they also incorporated a no carbon company called No Carbon Milk, No Carbon Cheese. So it's a huge farm working in different fields. And their CEO is in our board of advisors just because I watched him talking in this webinar, and I was like, I need to, you know, understand what you're doing, because there's not a lot of people doing this in Brazil, and now he's in our board of advisors, so it's pretty cool. And in the region that we are at, 80% of our suppliers come from 40 kilometers from the factory, so we are very local. And when we started building the factory, in the same time we were looking for smallholder farmers that had this mindset, and there was zero, no one in the surroundings. And this is a big agribusiness area. No one was looking at agroforestry or having these principles. And so we started going to the government and to different institutions to find resources to go to at least one smallholder farmer and do him as a living lab for others to see what he's doing. And we were funded by the International Development Bank to do this the shift from one farm that do raw milk cheese to do a carbon neutral raw milk cheese. So we're implementing this project powered by the International Development Bank. But this is just something that you need to go through different areas. Just because we're a small company, we don't have the resources needed to educate and do workshops, but we're a voice now in the region. So much to be done.
And with that one farm, let's say, in transition now, is the interest shifting? And of course, with your interest to buy these ingredients, like there is an off-taker, there is a buyer for this. It's not that you're pushing them to change to something and then there's nobody to buy anything. Is it shifting the conversation over the last, like, as you see that something concrete is happening, is there something shifting, or is it still, pushing up the hill?
No, it is. From 2 years to now, and obviously after ESG became big with big food companies, there is a need for suppliers, and you see big companies like Danone or Unilever or Nestle, they're looking for the smallholder farmers that does any of this practices. And at the last food summit, we were part of this program powered by Rockefeller Foundation. And I don't know if you heard of it. It's called Game Changers Lab. Did you hear anything about it? Yeah.
I've heard about it, but tell me what it is, because I've...
Yeah, it was an interesting topic. So they, for the Food Summit, the IDEO and the Rockefeller Foundation and a lot of different institutions came up with this sort of accelerator where they divided into 24 cohorts. And my cohort was to scale agroforestry, was to find a solution to scale agroforestry. And we had people from Africa, Europe, here in Brazil, and different people working this project for 6 months. And we came up with this idea called Agropedia, where a smallholder farmer, and since I'm from the farm, my parents are from the farm, I know the reality of a Brazilian smallholder farmer. He doesn't have the resources to do this shift. So Agropedia, it's an online resource where he goes and see, you know, I have a farm and this is the size of the farm. What's the marketplace? You know, like who's going to buy from me? What's Danone wants? What Nestle wants? Or what these big companies want? And what are they willing to pay? Because there is a premium price for this product. And so Agropedia is coming. We also were funded, and we are just developing the platform to do some research, to give to some smallholder farmers some resources to do this shift. But it's a work in progress. I mean, it takes long. It's going to be a long journey.
And what kind of products, like what products do you think, let's say you had a clean slate, you can develop any product you wanted, I mean, the resources are there. What would you develop to unlock that potential of agroforestry? Like what would be needed to really pull instead of push, maybe?
There is this number that I always oftenly think that we can eat 31,000 different plants, and 43% of all we eat comes from corn, wheat, and soy. I mean, it's just We narrowed down so much the possibilities that we have. So here in Brazil, obviously, there are the superfood ingredients from the rainforest, but savanna itself, it's in the biome that we are working in the factory, it's at there's so many nuts and fruits and, you know, acai that's so famous in Brazil. It's a super ingredient, but you have manioc as a root. You have coffee here in Brazil, pretty big, and there's just so many resources. And in my company, what we're trying to do is to put livestock in the equation, because I feel that there are a lot of people working with plant-based products, and we see from FAO's forecast that the consumption for meat and dairy products are going to increase at least, we're going to increase at least in 50% till 2050. So we need to find ways to put, you know, the cow in the equation. So to me, I'm more interested in understanding how we can work with dairy products in a regenerative perspective, and obviously using other resources such as manioc to create these amazing tasty products.
Yeah, do you see that? I mean, that is there the pushback as well in Brazil on let's say the animal agriculture side? And your story or your push there to say, let's see how we use the cow and not necessarily take that completely out of the equation. Is that something that's been happening there? Because I see it globally, like it's immediately, let's get rid of all animals because we need to be plant-based. Yeah. And often forgetting that like fertilization has to come from somewhere. It's either from gas or from very, very large scale compost facilities, which we need a lot of time and space, or from animals. And I mean, we know the issues with gas, especially, I mean, not only environmental, but also political, as we see in the last last months. Like, is that discussion happening in Brazil as well? Like what, or is it more like the animal is still more part of the agriculture system or the future system of mostly, I mean, there's always city people that never visited a farm. Let's say, let's get rid of the animals. They saw a few documentaries and think how agriculture works. But how is that discussion when you say, I want the animal to be part of the system? Is that, you get pushback for that or not?
Yeah, so Brazil has more cows than people. Can you imagine that? We're a huge player.
I'm currently in a country, I mean, the Netherlands slaughters, which is not a good thing at all, 1.2 billion chickens a year. So, I mean, there are places which you would be surprised about the amount of animals. But, okay, so the cow is a fundamental, it's a strong part of the culture.
It's a strong part, and we export a lot of it, but we consume a lot of meat in Brazil as well. It's part of our cuisine. And plant-based, it's rising, especially in food techs and startups, and venture capitals are looking for it. And I think it's a legit. And I think I think that we have we're missing out a huge opportunity to understand how we can use dairy products in a regenerative way. And we don't see a lot of venture capitals investing in this in Brazil. And a couple of months ago, I saw that Bill Gates invested in a no carbon milk, and everyone was like, you know, so, oh my God, you need to be investing in plant-based and this is not the solution. But we see that, you know, and this is one of the books that I'm reading, Defending Beef. Have you ever seen this book?
Yeah, we had her on actually, Nicola.
Oh, really?
I'll put it in the show notes around Christmas. Nice. Last year. It's very interesting.
It's so interesting
in terms of data and where a lot of these reports come from and how they are, let's say, statistical, not statistically, not really well, like well founded and never retracted. And these numbers stay out there. Like 50% of emissions come from livestock, which is, somebody once said it somewhere, it's completely nonsense, but it stays there forever in the general mindset. So I think so you're saying there's a huge opportunity there to look at dairy, which is true. I don't hear anybody or very few people talk about let's disrupt dairy. It's usually then plant-based instead of you saying, no, let's disrupt dairy with dairy. Yeah. And see how to do that. And what are examples of that? Like what are you working on or working with that is really fundamentally different from the dairy industry we now see, which is mostly inside, feeding a lot of soy and corn, even though sometimes organic, but still, that, I mean, there are a lot of questions to be asked. And then we get a dairy product out of there that, yeah, we can ask a lot of questions about. What is the dairy you're envisioning or working with?
So we work with smallholder farmers that have up near 50 hectares farm, so they're not big. So it's good in terms of how you can implement different systems and crop rotations, and you know, it's easier than big lands, but at the same time, they don't know about these resources, and that's the key issue that we're seeing, how we can bring the message to these farmers. So we're using this different institutions to support us, so government, the Ministry of Agriculture, Environment, and these different projects, such as the one that I've mentioned with the International Development Bank. But we are also starting different peers, other peers that are working with methane and how, you know, cow feed can decrease methane emissions, and how we can, the crop rotation can sequester carbon and decrease also gas emissions. And the taste of the product also changes a lot. And that's one of really? The key things. Yeah.
So how did it change since you, I mean, how would you, again, I mean, we're an audio program, but like how does the taste changes when the milk changes? Or what the cow ate and how the cow ate.
We need to develop so much in terms of how we understand food, because when you go to a chef, you go to a restaurant, you know that today you're going to have your favorite plate and tomorrow it might taste different, right? Have you ever had this experience where you go to a restaurant and like, it's slightly different, it's more, I don't know. You just know that you expect that from a restaurant. But when you go to the supermarket and you get a package, you, as a consumer, have this knowledge that you're going to have the same thing and the same, you know, taste over and over again, because that's how food industry developed our brain. Yeah. I mean, if you eat a McDonald's here in Brazil and another one in Japan, it's going to have the same taste because everything is ultra industrialized. And this is something that we are putting in the package. This is a natural, you know, with artisan ingredients and handcrafted ingredients. And it's going to taste the same because it's natural. And, you know, naturally, it's not going to taste the same. And that's one of the things that we see, that from different farms, and we buy from different farms the cheese, they just taste different. And we have in the factory, you have a room, a cheese room, and we say that they hear country music because, you know, the wines in Argentina or in France, they hear like opera or something. Yeah, like classic music. We hear country music, but just fun fact. But we see difference from different farms, and it just tastes better. I don't know how we haven't put it. Any lab data on it, but it tastes better. It depends.
Do you ever get complaints? Like people saying, yeah, but this wasn't, like, this package is different than that one?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Did you ever get comments on that? Like,
yeah, we
and
do.
And then what do you respond?
And the color is also different. And I'm like, okay, so the chicken put in some eggs that has more orange color in it this season. And, you know, that's just going to happen. And we don't
like
put
butter changes color. I had a conversation last week with someone and said, yeah, of course, during the season, butter changes. If you have grass-fed butter or grass-fed cows, the butter changes color and for sure changes fat content depending on the pasture, etc.
Exactly.
And they never thought about it. You could see the light bulbs going on like, oh my God, it's an alive product and it changes and it depends on the season, etc.
Exactly.
And like, is that, I mean, I can't imagine that your customers that are buying these products are off-put by that, because otherwise they would be going for the industrialized one. But how do you respond to that as a customer service? Like, yeah, this is nature. Welcome to the season.
Or we send pictures. Yeah, we have this new ladder called Nua, and we started 8 months ago after we were deep diving in the regeneration, and we just had this mission to inform consumer that everything changes. And it's so neat. I'm going to send it to you. It's in Portuguese, though. But it's so neat. We have a journalist that goes and interview chefs and go to farmers and interview them to see what's in the season. Just, I think that this is a message that we want to educate consumers to understand that nature doesn't, it's not in their disposal just because, you know, they want to. It's not because they want to eat avocado every month that they should be eating, because it's, you know, driving overseas this avocado, and it doesn't make any sense. And that's why the first question that you've asked, that's why I think that everything should be local. We need to be eating as much as we can things that are produced here and in the seasons, and respecting and nature.
When you see that enormous attention that, let's say, the industrialized plant-based meats get, or plant-based dairy, and the investors are all, it seems really hyped, or like the amount of attention going in that space. What would you tell a room full of investors about the excitement or the potential of regenerative dairy and regenerative cheese and regenerative beef, etc., or meat in general, or the protein side? Like, what would you say to a group? Like, imagine we're in a live theater and it's a room full of investors, and you've convinced them about, okay, nature is extremely important or extremely fundamental. They will walk out to at the end of the evening, and what would you tell them, obviously without giving investment advice, but where would they start looking more? Where would they start digging a bit deeper, or where to start as an investor in this space? Because it's so easy to join the hype on the left, let's say, yeah, or on the right, whatever side you choose, but the hype that is going, okay, we just have to build a lot of huge factories with fermentation fats, etc., and all these slides look amazing, and everything just goes up and up and up, and the rounds seem to never end. And then we're sort of in the other side saying, yeah, but actually there might be another way, and there might be a different way. Like, how do we, what would you tell them if investors are interested to explore further?
I would say that just look at the numbers and what size, you know, how big is dairy products compared to plant-based? How big is meat products compared to plant-based? It's going to only, I know that plant-based is going to increase, but meat consumption and dairy consumption is also going to increase. And these are the biggest sales in the supermarket. I mean, I have one of our distributors, he sells 400 million reais per year. He's huge, and 50% of everything that he sells, it's meat. So people are eating meat. It's part of their daily routine. They, you know, use butter in every morning, and they are eating cheese every morning. So I feel that they're missing out an opportunity to go to the market that it's already developed, is already inherent in every cuisine, every chef. And there is a lot of people in the plant-based, but few people in dairy, looking at dairy ingredients and meat itself. And I feel that we're just missing this opportunity to find, you know, how we can incorporate regeneration in the products they're already selling, and that they're in the biggest sales, actually, in the retail. So I would just look for this tradition. And people usually say, oh, you sell cheese bread. This is not, there's no innovation. There is no technology. Obviously, there is a lot of technology involved, you know, from a dairy perspective, but also from the manioc, that's the root, and that's going to come, the dairies up in it, and we're going to put the product up. But how many technology you can unfold from, you know, understanding manioc as a superfood ingredient, and you can have a pasta, or you can have a flour, you can have so many other ingredients, and bake it with dairy products. That's what we are trying to do.
I think it's a very interesting point. I mean, there's an enormous amount of innovation happening and needs to happen, which involves a lot of technology, but going to the sector that is already developed and that needs a massive shift. I mean, there's no question about it, but it's not going to disappear tomorrow, nor in 10 years, even if we completely are disrupted by any cellular ag, etc. It's just, I don't think it won't disappear that quickly. And so if we like it or not, we need to change that sector. Just as if we like it or not, in general, we need to change agriculture, even if tomorrow we invent the best modular nuclear fusion machine that we can scale really, really quickly and we get a fossil fuel in a second, or we scale solar extremely quickly, we still have to change agriculture if we like it or not. And so it's a shame that it's neglected, which should be very exciting for investors and other people in the space, because there are not so many others, which means you can make a huge difference and you can play a huge role if you want to. It's literally, as you were sort of referring to as calling it the desert, like you were quite lonely in that place, maybe still are partly, that is changing, but it's still, there's a lot of room for other innovation and there's a lot of room for investment and there's a lot of room for technology. I mean, people are like, oh yeah, let's go back to how it was 100 or 200 years ago. I think they really need to visit the farm and see the potential of drones, of certain light equipment, new robotics, of virtual fencing, of processing on the spot, or much more local, and to keep all this freshness of obviously the DNA sequencing, following bioacoustics. I mean, there's so much. I heard somebody's talking about an AI use case to help farmers incorporate cover crops. And I mean, there's a lot on the technology side to do there, but I think it's a really good message, like go where the opportunity is. And this is a blue ocean, basically. So what would you do if you would be an investor? Let's say you're not running new, because you cannot both run a company and put a lot of money to work,
but, and
have twins and do a gazillion other things for sure. But if you had to put, let's say, $1 billion to work, could be in Brazil, could be anywhere else. What would you focus on? Like, what would be the main? Would it be really on the food company side? Would it be on technology side? Would it be on transition finance? All of the above. But what would your main? Where would you start?
I'm very interested in understanding the power of SMEs. They're looking up different ways to produce products. So there is this group called the Good Food Hub that I'm involved in. It was created from Ian after the Food Summit. And it's a hub where there are a lot of SMEs around the world. We won the prize for United Nations 50 Best Small Business, and we are all together. And it's just so interesting to see these SMEs working in different fields to fix the broken food system. So I would definitely look at the small startups that are in different areas, just trying to understand how you can produce products in a nature positive way, and not just decentralizing the whole operation. Because that's just something that when you go to the supermarket and you see everything, all this packaging, this is agribusiness. You know, agribusiness is inside all of those packaging. So if SMEs don't look how they are impacting the whole system, who's going to do that? You know, big corporations are having their plans for 2040, 2050, but SMEs can shift now. And we did that. In 2 years, we shifted the whole model. So I would definitely look at SMEs around the world, and they're usually entrepreneurs passionate about, you know, they're climatarians and they're passionate about regeneration and regenerating also recipes, right? That's one of the things that we've mentioned. People are not talking so much about indigenous recipe or grandma recipes or things that you used to eat, your grandmother used to eat, and you don't find it any longer. So I would put some investment in those people.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, that sort of layer. I mean, it keeps coming back, I don't know, over the last 6 months or so, with Paul Lightfoot as well, which I would put in the climate neutral or climate positive food companies, like this layer, which is beyond the farm and sort of is that interaction between the farm or the land and our consumer or the hospital that buys it or the restaurant. I mean, but there is a layer in between, because many, many products, rightfully so, are not going to end up on a farmer's market, and we don't buy directly from the farmer because they have to be processed in a good way. And processing is not necessarily an ugly word, but somehow there is a transformation going on there. And that layer is so fundamental. And you're saying there's a huge opportunity there, but because there are these companies that can shift if they haven't already done so, and that have a lot of space to grow, because what you see, and I think just asking the question, the consumer is ready for this. The consumer wants clean label.
Exactly.
Not every consumer, but enough of it to have an interesting business.
obviously
have you seen a shift there as well?
Yes,
like the last years.
Yes, well, there was a research run here in Brazil last year and said that 83% of consumers want to buy sustainable products, but they don't want to spend more. So
okay,
that's a tricky thing, because they want to buy from, you know, local producers and obviously with impact, but they don't want to spend more just because inflation is huge here in Brazil. But I feel that we have an opportunity to produce products in a more intelligent way. And we saw that when we built the factory. I mean, it's cheaper to have clean energy, to have solar panels. It's cheaper to storage rainwater and use it in the factory. I mean, if you bring technology, but also sustainability and circular economy principles, it's going to be cheaper. It doesn't need to be more expensive, the product. And so there is obviously a shift. And I feel that food techs and startups, it doesn't need to be a food tech, but startups that are having CPG brands, they work in so many different areas, right? Because they dialogue with farmers because they need to buy the ingredients. They dialogue with co-packers, or they either process in their own factories. They dialogue with consumers. They dialogue with retails. I mean, there are so many different stakeholders they can change.
And
that's why I'm so interested in seeing how this food techs can change perception in different areas.
So you're arguing that that's the biggest lever we have, or leverage point we have, are the food companies, and especially the small to medium sized ones, because they're still nimble. They can shift around in a couple of years or a couple of months if they're very small, and they can grow quite rapidly and touch a lot of farmers, a lot of land, and a lot of people, obviously, on the consumer side, but also all the other stakeholders you interact with. They will be, and maybe at the beginning, they're annoyed that this regeneration piece comes up again. Or maybe they're like, oh, there they're talking again about recycled rainwater, etc. But at some point, it becomes almost normal. Like you're definitely opening a path there, which is very tiring, but also very needed.
Yeah. And I think that the key point, it's how much can we grow? And this was a aha moment that I had a couple of months ago. I was with my husband and we ordered McDonald's because we're in this business, but sometimes we drink Coca-Cola or something. You know, I'm not so rigid. And we ordered McDonald's and we were eating McDonald's. And I thought, if Nu was the size of McDonald's, how it would be? How could that be possible? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about CPG brands. Once they grow, they can't sustain regeneration that much because, you know, if I have 100 tons factory here in Brazil, but if I go to 10,000 tons per month, I'm not going to have the suppliers, local suppliers. I'm going to export to Netherlands and you're going to eat it. And, you know, we're just going to
break.
Yeah, it's a contradiction. So then I thought, how can a CPG brand be global and at the same time doesn't harm the ecosystem? And that's the theory that we are going through. And that's why I mentioned that we're going for the first round of investment, is that we're expanding, but being global, but at the same time being local. And that's the only way. You can't produce here in Brazil and export all around the world. You need to go to US and see who are the dairy producers, who are the ag producers, you know, how you can find local farmers and smallholder farmers, and how can you produce there and then sell it there, and go to Europe and go to, you know,
repeat. Yeah.
And repeat. Scale. Exactly. So you can be a global CPG brand and be a regenerative with a nature positive perspective, but you need to be local. That's the only way that we found.
Is that what you referred to at the beginning as scaling deeply? Is that the similar, or is that connected to it?
Yes.
And then how does it look like? Would it be sort of a collection of global brands under the same principles, guiding principles? Because would it be different food as well? Because
it's not
that you're
going to
make
different food.
Brazilian cheese bread in Kentucky, because that's, it would be a funny thing to eat, but it's not part of the culture. So would you then take the guiding principles and set up local, I wouldn't say versions, but like almost local version, but in like the local translated version of what you're building in Brazil or building
that's
so
exactly
far?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're gonna, obviously we don't have manioc in the US, and we're gonna need to import, but that's the only ingredient we need to import. The rest of ingredients we can find it locally, and that's the part of scale deep. You need to find local suppliers for your products. You can have a co-packer, it doesn't need to be, you know, you don't need to have a factory, but you can find local co-packers and work with the smallholder farmers. And if you reach a stage as we've reached here in Brazil, you can buy, you can build a factory, but it doesn't need to be a factory replicable, is that a word? As we are doing here in Brazil, but we're using Brazil as a living lab. And that's why the factory is within 40 kilometers from the farmers. And that's why we're putting the agroforestry from Petoterra. We're already doing free range eggs here. We need to learn, right? We need to learn so then we can teach to other farmers. And that's the only solution we see to scale the model, is to go deep, to go from soil to plate. That's the thing about CPG. You can go from soil to plate.
Two things on that. Wouldn't it be possible to find a local route that is, that so you don't have to import the manioc into some place? Like what would it be? Ideally, we would try to find the local route that is very unloved, but also a superfood and could be a perfect ingredient. Not sure if that's possible. And second, I'm imagining in Brazil, there are so many biomes and so many different regions that are so different from each other that there is a lot of space to repeat there as well. To repeat, because Brazil is enormous and yes, you're doing 40 kilometers, 80% of your ingredients come from 40 kilometers. That means there are a lot of these radiuses you can draw on the map and set up another one.
Yes, that's part of the plan. But what we want to do for next 2 years is go to US just to prove that we can replicate the model internationally. But in Brazil, we have opportunities to go to north, for instance. We're in the center of Brazil, but we mapped producers in the north, and in the south, they're doing great. They're using dairy, their dairy farms, producing amazing cheese and milk. But yeah, that's the knowledge. Just have this small production in different areas and produce it in small scale, and then you can be and scale up.
And if you could change one thing overnight in the food and ag space, what would that be? You have a magic wand, you have the magic power to do one thing differently, and tomorrow morning we wake up and that's the case. You have done one thing. What would that be?
There's so many things I would do, but
I know. That's why it's one.
But I will again try to localize everything. I will again try to shift the way we consume and not have avocado every month, and just educate consumers and find what's in the surroundings and restore biomes and restore, you know, local biodiversity. We saw that we lost 60% of biodiversity since the 70s, after we grew a lot at the agribusiness. So we lost so much, and we came to this tipping point where there's no coming back. And I feel that if we localize and see what is, you know, in the state and what can be produced, there's so many amazing products that the indigenous used to eat, and we don't have the privilege to do it. So that's, you've mentioned about a root in US, I bet they have, and I bet we can use it, and it's going to taste a little bit different, but it's going to be as yummy, you know. And for us, we always say that taste is queen, because that's the most important part of CPG brand. But I will localize if I could have a magic wand.
And how does that contradicts almost your wish to repeat in the US, if you have so much work laying out for you for the next decades, probably in Brazil? Why not simply between markets, but inspire someone in the US to do this as well? Why do you need to do that, which is far from culture, far distance, simply because it's going to be running two brands in two different countries, etc.? Why is there that wish to do something in the US if you have so much work and so much things have to be rebuilt or built in Brazil as well?
I feel that I have a personal wish to extend the knowledge that we are learning here with NU to different SMEs around the world. And that's part of what we are doing. We're in so many forums in different United Nations and the Good Food Hub and just different institutions that we're just explaining things in the way that we're doing here. But there is just a personal wish for me and my family want to move to US and spend a couple of years there and with the twins and just bring everything that we're learning here to different countries. And that's one of the ways that we can increase impact the most. Not only have all knowledge stored in my company, but understand how we can inspire and really explain to other SMEs what we are learning, what have been, you know, going right, what have been going wrong, and all knowledge shouldn't be only with us.
Thank you so much for that. And I want to be conscious of your time. And I don't think it's the last time we'll be chatting. And thank you so much for sharing this super early morning before, I think, an important board meeting to share with us the journey of a SME CPG brand going all in into regeneration. And it's a journey, a fascinating one, never done. Definitely a very necessary one. So thank you so much for the work you do and for coming on here to share about it.
Well, thank you. I've sent you the video of me at Suma Uma in the botanical garden here in Rio, but it was a true one. I'm very inspired by your podcast and everyone that you're interviewing, and I'm so grateful that there is a movement and that we're part of this movement, and so it's a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.